listen to the Black Guy Who Tips podcast because Rod and Karen are hot.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Black Guy Who Tips. I'm your host Rod, and I'm joined as always by my co-host
Karen.
And today there's no rap intro, there's no witty up front. We are actually put in a previously recorded episode of Medium Talk, my spinoff show. There's an interview show with our girl Tia Oso, who is an activist and like a public figure and a bunch of other stuff. I mean, she's out in these streets, okay?
Yes.
Doing the work. At any rate, tragedy befell her her family home, man, and a monsoon storm destroyed her home, her family's home, and you know, she's been trying to get that fixed up and stuff. And I put a link to the GoFundMe that she has for raising funds to try to, you know, help get this get her home restored and her family taken care of, because you know, people don't have anywhere to stay. And I know people in communities are coming together to help, which is so beautiful. And I thought, you know what, we did a great interview a while ago. It's just me and her, no Karen. It was a great interview a while ago, and she's one of those people that I'm like, yo, I hope our audience can maybe go out there and help if you can. You know, we talk about activists all the time and how they do so much stuff, and it's almost like a thankless job.
Come on.
You know, when you need something, all of a sudden it's like, what the fuck is this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, man, she was a great interview. I think you guys are going to enjoy it just based off of that. We talked for a long time. I normally only schedule these things for an hour, and we ended up talking almost 2 hours. We had such a good time. Check it out. We'll play it right after this little intro here. Thank you so much, and don't forget to leave feedback on theblackoutist.com. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, you guys can email us, all that type of stuff. Leave us 5-star reviews. Appreciate everybody takes time out to do that.
We do.
And with no further delay, enjoy this interview with Tia Oso. And
yes,
if you can, if you have the means, and you can put a little something on it, I'm sure it's extremely expensive to fix what's going on with her house.
Right.
When you go to the GoFundMe and you see that first picture, you're gonna be like, okay, what the hell?
Right.
So, yeah, man, if you guys can chip in, every little bit counts, and spread the word, share the campaign online and stuff like that with your social media. All right, guys, enjoy this interview, and if you're premium and you heard it already before, listen again, or we'll talk to you tomorrow. If you're not premium, hey, this is what premium sounds like. This is one of the many shows that we have. Everybody else, thank you.
1, 2, 3, 4, Medium Talk.
So we're going to hold this thing. We're going to acknowledge the things of Black women that have died in the city of Texas. And then that we don't know, we do have questions for you about what's going on. To make sure that Black lives matter, and that as the leader of this nation, will you advance a racial justice agenda that will dismantle, not reform, okay? Not reform, but that will dismantle structural racism in the United States.
Hey guys, guys, welcome to another episode of Medium Talk on the Black Autist Premium Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rod, and joined by a very special guest today. I first came across this woman by looking at Twitter when Bernie Sanders was speaking at Netroots, and that was during a protest action, and I went, who is this with this fro on this stage, like black power fist in the air? I said, who is that? And and people that know the history of the show and Twitter and stuff know that I made a joke about Bernie being so black because there was a pushback towards these activists who were speaking out about Black Lives Matter and say her name, and people got so frustrated and mad at them, and they were just Bernie March with King, and so that started like a whole thing. And, but since that time, I followed her on Twitter and, you know, just really been, blown away by her mind. And, I always love, you know, getting her opinion on things. It's Tia Oso. What's going on, Tia?
Hey, Rod. I'm so excited to be on the show today. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no. Thank you, for coming on. Like I said, I've been, just secretly stalking you for like 2 years now. So, I'm happy to finally, you know, talk face to face, so to speak. So, you guys can find her work, TiaOso.net. You can also follow her on Twitter like I do. It's at Tia_Oso. And by the way, when I followed you, I still remember being like, how does she not have like a million followers? Like this is, like Twitter's just not a meritocracy is what I'm saying, guys.
It's really not a meritocracy. And then funny thing about that, I had another, like a personal Twitter, and then I made that the Twitter account I use now, after I went to like a job search clinic and they were saying you got to have a professional Twitter. And so I had more followers on my other Twitter, like my, you know, not politically correct Twitter. And then after we did the Netroots action, you know, I put one little tweet up, like a little hint that it's about to go down, and it just blew up. And so now, it's growing. I haven't really tried to cultivate a following. And so I feel like, you know, every follower I get is organic. And so that makes me feel good.
Yeah, you got, and you have the blue check mark, but you know, it's just, you know, the, as a person of the check mark,
blue check official. Yeah. It's like a fraternity.
Us checkies, you know, we like to talk to each other checkies, from time to time. And, but yeah, I'll tell you guys something. It ain't what it's cracked up to be. Like you end really up on not. A lot of people's list that you're like, oh no, I wish you didn't know I existed.
Right, right. You get on people's radar. Sometimes it's cool. Like there are other, you know, blue check people that I feel like, you know, I get to interact with and I wouldn't if I didn't have a blue check. And then there's, you know, the random trolls that pop. I was like, how? You don't have nothing else to do today?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I have so many filters on at this point. I'm just like, I hope people I love aren't trying to contact me and get them filtered out, because I just can't take these folks. So Tia, what led you to like activism as like a cause and a lifestyle and all that stuff? Like what's the origin story behind all that?
So my roots in activism really have to do with, number one being born and raised in Mesa, Arizona, which for people who are not familiar, you know, Arizona is a red state and Mesa is a very conservative place where the people who control it are Mormon conservative people. And so very, and very white, just, you know, to put it plainly. And so the neighborhood that I grew up in was a historically segregated area. Basically, there was like the city line and then the unincorporated territory. And they made all of the colored people live in the unincorporated territory. They called it Northtown. Mm. And so like that's where my grandparents and my mom were raised up. And so I was raised with kind of this, you know, awareness of like, look, this is where we live. This is why, you know, this neighborhood is all black and brown. And then my mom, Ellen Oso, she was an ACORN organizer and just really active in the community. And so she instilled in me the idea that if you want a change to happen, you have the power. I have the power and I have the voice to speak up and defend myself. And also, you know, she raised me and my siblings to be that way because of how really hostile, you know, looking back, she didn't use those words, but the hostility of like growing up in a white supremacist environment is like, you have to know how to speak up for yourself because these white individuals will try to take your humanity from you at every turn. And so I had to use my voice to speak up for myself many times, even as just a child, in the public school system there. And I have a kind of a natural inclination towards, standing up for what's right. I was a tattletale growing up. So if I felt like something wasn't right or something was wrong or I heard somebody, you know, telling a fib, I would be naturally just out of my, on my own accord, be like, no, this is not what happened. This is what happened.
Yeah, we have a natural disdain for the tattletale, and like even adults push that down on us. Like it's children, like, don't be a tattletale. Right. But at the same time, we're constantly like, stand up for what's right. Don't let anybody bully you. Don't, like, it's exactly. Such a mixed message. Like,
which is it? So I didn't have I grew up, you know, in the 80s before the stop snitching, you know, campaign. Mm-hmm. So I was, my nickname was Record, Rewind, and Replay. I would literally tell the truth and the whole truth at any given moment. Like, I had no filter. So, yeah, that's really how, like, that, my natural inclination, and then just how I was raised and being in a hostile environment, you know, it's enough to radicalize anybody who's, you know, just even a little bit conscious. And then as a teenager, I got involved with, kind of, you know, diversity and inclusion and leadership development programs. And then, in 2010, I was working in the arts and like public arts advocacy and doing independent artist shows and just a part of that world. And, when SB 1070 hit, just me and my roommates, you know, two other Black girls, we happened to live in an area where Joe Arpaio, the former Maricopa County Sheriff, used to do a lot of his sweeps where he would literally just, him and his sheriff deputies would just pull over any brown person and ask them about their citizenship and harass them and put them in like literal paddy wagons in the parking lot of like grocery stores on random street corners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being an activist and just, my volunteer time, you know, doing things like NAACP and other things like that, I just knew that this was wrong. And so I started to participate in the resistance that was happening in Arizona that was led by Latino immigrant activists, and indigenous activists there. And that is how I ended up meeting Opal Tometi, who's the executive director now of Black Alliance for Just Immigration. She and I became friends, and a small group of us started talking about what it would look like to organize in the Black community in Phoenix. Mm. And then eventually, just because of the political moment, you know, her activism, our friendship, I ended up becoming a volunteer and then organizing with Black Alliance for Just Immigration.
Wow. And there's a few things you hit on there. One, how'd your mom feel about, you know, Acorn being like attacked and defunded and all that stuff, during that scandal, being that she worked for them?
Yeah, she was really upset. And I love that, you know, my mom is not a scholar or and wasn't, you know, a public activist at all, but her analysis was so clear about how, you know, the takedown of Acorn was really about consolidating conservative political power. Mm-hmm. And also, the evidence of how liberals just lack the courage of their convictions to really stand up against really coordinated slander and smear attacks by the right wing. And, you know, just their unwillingness to call out the fact that, you know, you're targeting this organization because they have, in within their base is, you know, grassroots, poor folks, people of color. And the fact that Acorn was taken down the way that it was and so swiftly and with no plan of action to replace or, you know, regroup, she was like, you know, this is just a way to weaken the progressive movement. And she was right about that.
Yeah, it's weird because I feel like liberals or I guess the left or whatever is kind of like Batman, where they, you know, like they won't kill and they have rules and they won't violate the rules. And like at the end of the day, there's a respect to be had for the fact that you stand by your integrity and shit. but at the same time there's like a it's like, but you're losing, you know, like
yeah, it's not tactical. So you have to have, you can have morals, but you also have to have tactics and strategy. Right. And having the moral high ground but seeding actual material ground, right, in the fight for justice, to me it's admirable morally. And also I live in a marginalized community that could really use a strong political voice, right?
Right. Right. I'd rather win, you know, like Batman beats up the Joker and he never kills him, so morally he's right, but then the Joker's back out there killing people, right? So like I'd rather win than be kind of well, listen, it was kind of offensive what she said, so we're gonna shut down. I mean, I remember when Van Jones got let go.
Man.
Right, and I'm like, but he didn't really say nothing that wasn't true. It wasn't that bad. And now you look at, you know, the current occupants of the White House and the things that are constantly said, and you're like, they just care about winning. And unfortunately, I feel like it takes that sort of push back on the other side in order to gain any ground, you know?
Exactly. And if you notice, like, the Van Jones is an excellent example. I think there are other examples of the kind of political casualties that the left and liberals are willing to make, which is, you know, even touching on the Netroots action and the whole context of that and where we are now. The problem is not that Van Jones actually was an issue. The problem is that in order to try to appeal to middle American values and people's low sensibilities and understanding of politics, they were willing to sacrifice Van Jones. They were willing to sacrifice, you know, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, because what the coded language and the attacks on those activists and those individuals is about being strong and black and political. Mm-hmm. And you have to be palatable and black and political to a certain extent, the higher that you go up with the Democratic Party. And so again, it making those types of concessions without having a plan to how to, you know, invest in your base and strengthen your base, all you're doing is ceding ground and ceding territory. Mm-hmm. So now Van Jones is a pundit and an activist and, you know, is in a whole different orientation to political activism and resistance work, when if he had been able to remain in the cabinet of the White House, who knows what types of like deeply entrenched policy there would be on the behalf of the most marginalized in our community. And so that is really kind of textbook of what's wrong with liberalism, is that you're trying to play the middle. You actually don't want to strongly represent or defend my best interest. Mm-hmm. If it's going to mean that you ruffle the feathers of other white people.
Right. There's no middle on some of this stuff. And,
exactly.
There's become like this false, like I call it, performative impartiality, right? Where,
yes.
We have to do the, well, I mean, it's not like Trump voters are always wrong or something like that. You know, like, well, sometimes people do the right thing, or let's bring on a known bigoted racist like Jeffrey Lord and have him argue with Van Jones every day of the week for an hour. And you're like, these things aren't these aren't actual two level talking playing fields where people are both using facts and stuff. This is more just us pretending that we can have a conversation when there's no conversation to be had. And I feel like that is something that as a, you know, lifelong person that is going to always probably vote Democrat till I die because of you know, the way things are set up in this country. the way my country is set up, like, I'll probably
right, the way my country is set up,
you know,
it's gonna be a Democrat left-leaning vote.
Right, yeah, like, it's gonna be real hard. I can't ever see myself pulling the lever for a Republican. But you, like, know, it's kind of frustrating because like I said, these conversations, quote-unquote, that play out, it does feel like the left loses ground, and it's hard to defend any of this stuff. Speaking of which, you know, you brought up SB 1070. And for people that don't know what SB 1070 is, can you kind of like explain what it was for Arizona?
Yeah, so SB 1070 was a piece of legislation passed in the Arizona State Legislature that made it a state level felony to be undocumented, so to, you know, not have been naturalized or have some type of legal immigration status current, and then it also made it compulsory for law enforcement officers if they suspected for any reason that you might be in the country undocumented to question you about your citizenship, and it authorized law enforcement officials to question people's citizenship. It did a lot of other things. It made it they made restrictions on what types of state benefits people who are undocumented were able to access, different types of contracts and things. And what a lot of your listeners might not know, just an education point, is that the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which is a national policy think tank organization that lobbies and helps to fund a lot of conservative legislators across the country. That piece of legislation was written and crafted by ALEC, and in particular, Chris Kobach, who is now the person who's over our voting rights in this country. SB 1070 is a piece of legislation that came out of that conservative policy mill at ALEC. And Arizona, because it has a supermajority GOP legislature, is a testing ground for a lot of conservative legislation because they're able to get anything that they would like passed. And so SB 1070 was one of those bills that they floated in Arizona and got passed in, you know, in order to try to make people's lives, you know, live in hell, quite frankly. It's not really because Arizona was so overrun by undocumented immigrants on welfare that, you know, the government was being bled dry. Right. It's about controlling people who are not white men.
Yeah, you know, the thing, too, is it's a unifying issue for whiteness, right? Like, hey, here is an other that we can pick on, and then there's people that, you know, normally wouldn't even be interested in this stuff that are like, oh, someone I can blame for everything wrong in my life, or someone that I can feel superior to. Well, yeah, I'm on board with this law. And I think there, you know, it was you know, undocumented people, but, you know, other places it's been, you know, black people, it's been indigenous people, but it's always just like, I mean, the president of the United States at this point, like, it's a galvanizing cause to be able to say, like, what about these other people, though? And it's like, oh, yeah, you know what? I'll tolerate you. I'll vote for you if I get to feel better than these people. We covered so much stuff on the show at that time for Arizona. I just remember it was like a running gag on the show just to be like, oh, my God, Arizona, they're trying to catch up with Florida, you know, like.
Yeah.
It was just so, it was so ridiculous, but you know, I know three parts of the law was like struck down by a judge, but still that law passed, you know, like it's just sickens me. But you know, it's also interesting that that was kind of a start for your activism, and it wasn't really about quote unquote you specifically, you know, like a lot of people don't even really get activated into that kind of stuff until it's something that's directly affecting like them in particular.
And that is an issue because, you know, I feel like, you know, activism wise and it's fine to be galvanized by something that impacts you directly, but that's also a reason why I'm such a advocate and proponent for political education, which is the work I'm transitioning into now, because people have to understand systemic issues and they have to understand the way that things actually do affect you. And really, at the end of the day, we're all connected. That, you know, society is an ecosystem. There's not something happening to one person and it's not happening to me. It's like, actually, there are impacts that are affecting everyone. The reason why food prices are going up, and other issues that are connected towards us having a working well-supplied labor industry is being affected to where, you know, there are farmers who don't have workers because of the attack on immigrants. That doesn't have anything, quote-unquote, to do with somebody who's not an immigrant, but it does because I also would like to have affordable food, you know?
Yes,
so, yes. SB 1070 was really personal to me, not only because I grew up in a heavily, you know, Latino neighborhood, but also because legalized racial profiling isn't going to be good for anybody who's not white. Mm-hmm. And I could see the writing on the wall that if we allow them to pass this law, just because white people are very good at dog whistles, and so just because somebody is saying Mexicans, we got to get rid of them, they didn't write the law against, like, SB 1070, they didn't write that law against Mexicans. It said if you are suspected of being in the country illegally,
right,
then the law enforcement officer has the license to harass you. That sounds like racial profiling. That mm-hmm. is racial profiling, because how else can that law be interpreted? And it's not that they're, like, people don't know, there are mad undocumented Canadians and mm-hmm. Irish people all over the country, even in Arizona. Nobody's ever going to ask them whether or not exactly. they're a citizen, because this is the United States.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, as a black person, I'm just worried that, you know, I say the wrong thing and all of a sudden I start looking a little bit Mexican to this dude or whatever, you know, like, exactly. you know, like, oh boy, you got some mouth on you. I feel like you might not be from here, you know.
I feel like you might not be from around here. And then, you know, if you talk to black immigrant folks, that is what happens, is, you know, they start speaking with their accent, and the next thing you know, depending on the officer who they're interacting with, the next thing you know, they are getting questioned.
Right, exactly. So that, but I, you know, that that intersectionality, though, like, to be motivated by not just your plight, but just also the connection back to what will eventually come to you, because I feel like that too. Like, I remember during the 2016 election, people being like, you know, I don't like Hillary Clinton, which, you know, I understand. There's a lot of people that don't like Hillary Clinton.
Totally understand.
Like, I'm not going to fight you on that. But I always was like, yes, but Trump is just worse. Like, at least for the things I believe in, I can't imagine letting an open bigot into an office.
Exactly.
I personally couldn't do it. But I remember being like, even if I were to see that Hillary Clinton is racially problematic towards black people, therefore, whatever policy she was going to pass or whatever would be equally as bad to Trump. I don't think that's the truth, but let's say I did think that was the truth. I still have all these other people that exist that I know are going to be affected negatively because their policies do differ, right? So, it's like, at this point, I'm not even really voting for myself. Like, I'm like,
right, you're voting for the greater good.
Yeah, I don't want to live in a world where I have to watch the progress that was made in 8 years for trans people, for LGBTQ marriage equality,
the environment.
Right, like, I just didn't want to, right, like, like, I care about Flint. I don't live there, but I care. Like,
but I care,
you know. And I feel like, I don't know, maybe we've kind of lost that a little bit, or maybe we never really had that, but some of the discussion around it, it's almost like, as a matter of fact, this will be my next question. Like, I think social media kind of changed us a little bit, in that we all get to kind of be the star of our own reality show and our own pulpit. And we all get to, like, soapbox for ourselves sometimes. And I think we can become myopic that way, where it's like, well, this is how I feel, so then F everybody else. And, you know, like, this is my issue, and my issue is the most important, so nobody else's issue should matter. Have you felt like social media changed activism, or changed the way people feel about it in the time that you've, since, like, SB10 and whatnot?
Yeah, definitely. I think I love the potential for social media and the way that social media has allowed me to be conscious of, and also in some ways support activism and on causes that I'm not directly impacted by, and also in areas where I don't live physically. So, you know, I learned about the killing of Oscar Grant in Oakland. I learned about that from Twitter. You know, the hashtag, what's now, you know, hashtag Black Lives Matter, and other, you know, issues, fees must fall, like in South Africa. I think that without social media, I know that without social media, I wouldn't have been as aware of these issues, and I wouldn't have been able to connect and amplify and in sometimes, you know, participate in activism and digital, you know, advocacy. But also, and also, social media, the kind of the legitimacy, you know, the way that I feel like our human interaction works and the way that our brains work, when you see something written down or said, you know, on a video that's coming through a platform, it legitimizes it in a way to you, in a way that, you know, somebody on, you know, on social media, it's like a street corner, you know, proselytizer and a pastor on the same, like, equal footing.
Yes, yes.
And so it's almost like, and it's not that, you know, different voices shouldn't be amplified and validated. I just think that we weren't prepared to develop the kind of critical thinking and analysis and filters to be able to really sort information. And so that's what we see happening now with, you know, the way that Steve Bannon and, you know, the Russian operatives are able to manipulate people's attitudes during the elections, is that the legitimacy that's given to every voice that people come across means that if I can get it in front of your eyes, I can capture your attention, right?
Yeah.
And so that is the danger is not the social media itself. The danger is people's lack of critical thinking skills.
Yes.
And people's the kind of tendency to see something that is popular, or how many retweets or how many likes, and then also the echo chamber, because it's who you follow, right?
Right.
And so you're curating the information, and so it's kind of a perfect storm of helping to kind of make it seem as though there's a certain opinion or a certain sentiment that really isn't true or representative. The other thing about social media is that, yes, there are millions of users, but I don't know that it's actually representative of the average person.
Right.
There are many people who aren't on social media, or they don't use it to talk politics.
Right.
That I think that we really just don't know what their opinions really are. And we also don't know whether or not they could be persuaded differently if we're only using, you know, social media type platforms to interact with folks, to educate folks, to have public discourse. You know, there used to be a lot more kind of venues for political discourse. Like I was, you know, we were interacting on Twitter a little bit about, you know, public debate. There used to be a lot more public debate. There used to be a lot more lectures. There used to be a lot more television programs where people would, you know, there's something to be said for talking quietly. People used to like actually talk quietly in dialogue, you know, on mainstream primetime television. And it's not that they weren't having differing opinions or that everybody was a scholar. You know, they had Muhammad Ali, you know, often on primetime television. There used to be a more open venue for logical discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is what I think helped people to be able to make up their own minds or understand issues in a different way. And social media and the kind of outrage politics and ratings, you know, manipulation that the mainstream, you know, media outlets do, I think has contributed to, you know, what the state of things are now.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point about the open public debate too, because while there would be some gatekeeping, obviously, to like who gets to be on TV and who decide, you know, like, oh, I took a liking to this particular person, so that person gets to be on TV all the time or whatever, right? But in general, we have gone away from that. I wonder how much of that is because now there's so much more competition for eyes. Like, everything's so monetized. Everything's such a spectacle. I mean,
exactly. That monetization, that capitalism.
Yeah. Like, news has changed over our lifetime, right? Like,
yeah.
There was a time when you may have like a sit down kind of interaction of, let's bring on these two black people and they're going to discuss this these current events or whatever. And if that is, I don't think that's as that gives as much attention now as if, well, let's bring on Jeffrey Lord and have him argue with Van Jones. That clip will go viral.
People,
you know, so I feel like the sensationalism around it, because they are selling ads, they are, you know, that there is more competition now. There's Hulu, Netflix, there's probably like 40 or 50 cable TV stations now that have their own original programming. I wonder how much of that is just kind of eroded the substance behind you know, the value, I guess, behind putting something of substance on your TV, you know. And I do feel like in a way, like, that stuff has moved to social media, but as you brought up, the social media conversations are very, they're very loud in their own way. Like, people aren't,
they are
yeah, like, you're not using your actual physical voice in it, but the way people kind of attack each other, and it's more about winning, and it's more about I don't know, getting the most like pats on the back and retweets and stuff.
It's
a very different type of arena to have a conversation in, because I feel like in real life, when I disagree with people, we're not, well, I would say for most people, when I disagree with them, we're not that far apart, like the people that I do disagree with. Like, if a perfect example is socialism on Twitter, like black socialism on Twitter is very like loud and angry to me, like toward, like in my mind I'm like, oh god, no, I don't want any of that. But
you mean
then,
like, politically socialist?
Yeah, like when people, people who are claiming like, I'm a socialist, I'm black, and I'm mad about this, and I'm like, and I'm like, oh no, like that's what, I don't want to be that, if that's what that is. But then anytime I have a conversation with somebody off Twitter and it's about that, or if I read a book or something, and I'm like, oh no, 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 I can get with this. I see why, like, I don't know that we can change our country to this, like, I don't know if it's possible, but I definitely understand the intent, and we honestly want the same things. Like, we, like, I do want to live in a world where people don't have to be poor. Like, I don't, I do want to live in a world where you know, you're not just picking winners and losers money wise I do want to live in a world where I feel like marginalized people have a voice politically, as well as you know, just the right to live. Like, I don't want privatized prisons, or like a prison industrial complex in general. Like, it, you know, there's things that I'm like, well, yeah, who would be against that? I mean, at least as a black person, I'm like, who would be against that? But it's different, like I said, on social media, when someone's like, you idiot, neoliberal shit, it's like, oh no, I don't want to even talk to you about this.
And right, I don't even want to discuss this with you. You're calling me names.
Right, and so we are missing that. Like, I do feel like if two people that are fighting on Twitter sat down and were actually like, had a moderated debate or panel or something, I know it wouldn't look like that. So you're right. That is a, I mean, when you brought that up the other day, I was just like, yeah, that is brilliant. Like, we've never, we haven't had that since like James Baldwin and Malcolm X and, you know.
Exactly. Like, since the 60s. The closest thing, I was also thinking around, the kind of the hip hop activism era in the 90s, you know, interviews with like Sister Soulja and people like Kevin Powell and things like that. Like, it hasn't been since maybe I would say the 90s where you would have like really like moderated, widely, you know, wide public discourse on issues, and not just, you know, kind of sound bites.
Yes.
And, again, like this back and forth. I also think that I've been really looking into and discussing, and trying to learn more about this intersection around like tech and social justice, because the design of platforms like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, the monetization, the algorithms, you know, Instagram also plays into those instincts, right, and how our brains are wired for gratification, for validation. And so it, there's also something to be said about the way that the platforms, the way that people interact with these platforms, that is also feeding into that. And, you know, there are people spend millions of dollars, billions of dollars around manipulating that without a lot of concern, I think, for the consequences. Right. And I mean, who knew that the fallout from having a platform like Facebook? I remember when Facebook, you know, launched, and we got it at Arizona State University in like 2003, 2004. There's no way that I would have known then that Facebook would be what it is now today,
right,
and would be responsible for, you know, influencing public opinion about whether or not Hillary Clinton is a legitimate political candidate.
And also, like, they took out ads for Black Lives Matter that said, that show, like, women holding guns and stuff. Like,
listen,
no one could have
Who knew?
Right.
Who knew that you would be able to publish baseless information and target people with it? Who knew that?
I thought what was so interesting is number one, I think what Tia and I are both agreeing on is that we miss Teen Summit. Okay, guys?
BG, yes, thank
bring
you.
It back, okay?
Bring Teen Summit back.
I need it, okay? I don't even care.
Where's Ananda?
Right, yeah, I'll take Adult Summit. Like, you can bring the original cast back, Middle Age Summit, and I'll still watch it.
Listen, I would love to be on an episode of Adult Summit, okay?
Come on, like, I would wear my dashiki for that, guys. So there's that part, and then also, like, the tech and the internet is a wild, wild west, right? And I don't think these companies necessarily were malicious. I think their ineptitude and just not knowing how bad things could get is absolutely still, you know, like, the effect is still the same, like, whether they mean to or not. Like, I don't think,
but,
like,
the thing is, somebody who's not white, right, and privileged, mm-hmm, might have thought about it twice.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Is is the problem for me is that the people at the top are white men, typically, and the way white men see the world is, mm-hmm, Richard Spencer is just as much about freedom of speech as Tia Oso is about freedom of speech to them. Like, those, right, are just two sides of a different coin. Like, the,
mm-hmm,
and that is how you end up with what we have, is that, you know, Twitter now is, I think right before I hopped on here, they suspended Rose McGowan, who is an actress. Yes, who's speaking out against Harvey Weinstein and Hollywood and this environment that allowed this sexual predator to roam unchecked and even enabled. They suspended her.
Why?
They just said she violated the rules. She suspended for 12 hours. She posted a screenshot on Instagram or something, right? And they told her she could either delete whatever the questionable tweets they decided were questionable, or she could wait 12 hours and she could post again. That's the environment. That, like, they don't see that as a biased environment. Like, white men don't see that as an environment that favors white men. The biggest sexual predator that is also president, they're never gonna suspend him, or
they're
ban
never
him.
Going to suspend his account,
right?
No,
no matter what he says, no matter what, no. You know, Jemele Hill gets suspended, yeah, from ESPN, and ESPN doesn't see themselves as an extension of the environment by suspending a Jemele Hill, but allowing Sage Steele to talk bad about people who protested at the airport when there was a ban.
Listen, when I saw those tweets, I was like, I don't know who Sage Steele is. I'm not a sports fan.
Yeah.
But who asked you?
Yeah,
I just don't understand.
And for the record, like, I just find it odd that she's a sports personality. She's right. Allowed to get political in that moment. Jemele gets political, and right, Jemele gets political, and she has to pay, and they don't even see that is a biased, like, they see that as fairness. Like, well,
right,
you know, I look, she got two politicals. Like, no, she's all talking about stuff y'all don't agree with. Like, that's not
exactly
the same.
Oh my gosh, I went to a forum recently at USC, University of Southern California, about sports and politics, and there was an ESPN executive, I think, there also was one of the panelists. And I think it's so interesting that they want to say keep politics out of sports, but it's very clearly a plantation. Really, all mm-hmm. of America is a plantation set up. Mm-hmm. And the idea that there's anything neutral, I mean, it's false. Like, basically, white men set up the parameters of what's neutral, right. and they kind of locate themselves as the neutral party, mm-hmm. and everybody else is biased.
Exactly.
And so that's why those algorithms are set up. I don't know what the offending tweet was that Rose McGowan tweeted, but I mean, there's plenty of trolls on Twitter roaming free, and I just don't see her.
I literally
have been problematic.
I went through all her tweets and was just like, I don't see any of them. What was the problem? But Twitter just decided at some point, like, these men feel attacked. You gotta go.
It's like a crowdsourced decision. It's like, yes. Oh, you got this many complaints. And almost like the volume of the complaints is what, determined that she should be suspended. That happens a lot on Facebook where mm-hmm. it could just be a general post about Mike Brown should have never been murdered. White police officers need to stop killing people indiscriminately. You banned.
Yep.
What?
Right. They're like, it's racist. I've been banned a couple times. They're like, I'm like, what was the, one of them was like, I think I made a joke about, what was it? It was something like, cause I was going to the Negro Museum, as I like to call it. I was going to the Black Museum in DC, and mm-hmm. I was like, oh yeah, when I was in there, I didn't even see like a section for the coons. And I like made a joke about like, you know, I don't know, Herman Cain or something. And it was like, you banned. I was like, I'm Black. Like, I get to say it. Like, I'm not
I
saying.
Get to say
like, I don't have much in this country, but I feel like I get to be like, can I say the N-word? I don't feel like y'all get to tell me I can't. Like,
did you name Herman Cain when you made the post?
I probably did. I don't even remember.
It's kind of like you was calling him a coon.
Yeah. Oh, I definitely was. I mean, I understand the respectability behind it, and I understand that it's offensive to some folks and they don't like it, and I get it, but I know a white person at Facebook don't get to decide. That's all. Like, if my mama came on the post and said, Rod, stop. Oh, go ahead, Tia. I'm sorry.
So you're like, please filter my post through the Black.
Yeah. Yeah.
Black authority figure.
Like, if my mom or my uncle wanted to hop on my page and be like, hey, can you stop calling people coons? Okay. Right. I get it. But like, if Larry in the Facebook, department says, I can't do it, I'm like, no, you don't get to decide. It's our word.
it's like Frida on Insecure when she'd be like, that's not cool. Like, Frida, you don't get to say
it. Yeah, you don't get to say it. Like, somebody else gotta decide. But that is a very real thing though. Like I said, I've been banned multiple times. Like, and sometimes it's just for like white people. Like, white people need to do this, and it's like, racism. Like,
racism.
What? What? Like, this country has done such a disservice because we don't educate anybody about racism beyond the surface. And historically, like, the United States, racism's role in crafting the entire United States and politically and everything. And so I feel like we are now seeing so many people that literally just don't know what racism is. Like, white people don't even know what it is, and yet they're now using, they have these big platforms where there's Black people on them and they have to deal with this stuff, and now things are more public with social media, so you can't hide your decisions anymore. And we're just seeing how inept these people are because they haven't been educated about it, they don't want to educate themselves, and they don't experience it. So to them, me saying stuff like you know, white people need to take responsibility for electing Donald Trump, to them, that's racism. They think that's the same as going, all Black people are thugs. You know, like, they think we're operating on an equal plane when we're not. And I think that's such a that's a big hurdle for tech, as you said, when it comes to social justice work and stuff.
Yeah, especially because, you know, the coders and the developers, they're coming in with limited knowledge, and are the culture in tech and you know, the kind of tech bro, dude bro, environment, I think also kind of squelches the idea and the consciousness level. So mm-hmm. people want to hold on to their idea that the definition of racism is about bad feelings and name calling mm-hmm. and not systemic. Same with sexism and gender issues. And so you have that coupled with there being a bias towards neutrality, quote unquote, and fairness. And so it is just as bad for you to call somebody a white person as it is for you to call somebody a nigger. Right. And it is just false. It's a false dichotomy that gets set up. And mm-hmm. there aren't another kind of larger piece of discourse that I am very challenged and frustrated with is the idea that there are sides. Like, there are human rights issues that we're talking about and people are, you know, being activated by, and the idea that there are sides, right. And people kind of set up these false, you know, oppositional dichotomies and give equal weight to both, you know, an extreme opinion and a moderate opinion, are a fact and an opinion mm-hmm. as though they're equally opposable. Exactly. And give it equal weight and value is a huge issue also, because you are not even able to argue or dialogue on you know, in a genuine context. Right. Like whether or not you are offended by my use of the term white person, the use of the term white person is not and has never been derogatory. Right. It's a descriptor. The use of the term nigger is, by the very definition of it, derogatory. Mm-hmm. How is it being weighed equally, except for if the person who typed the little words in for the flagging, right, mm-hmm. was like, oh yeah, white person is just as bad.
It makes me think of the time Don Lemon held up a sign that said, which of these is worse? And there was a Confederate flag and the other one said the N-word. And you're like, Jesus. Probably, you know, probably the one you can't say on TV. I would imagine the one that you can't actually put on there is the one that's worse. I mean, let's think about this. But that's that performative impartiality thing I was talking about earlier.
Yep. I like that phrase. I'm going to use that.
Yeah, man. Please have at it. Spread the word. Okay. I was watching The Daily Show, which I still watch and I do love, and I do think, Trevor Noah is good. He's getting there, guys. Okay.
He is. He's getting there.
Yeah. He's new here, guys. He's a little.
Right. I'm like, he's not American.
Right.
You gotta, you know, give him a chance.
Like, he gonna have his moments, y'all. Like, he gonna have his moments, but,
And also, I think that there's this idea that a black experience, that there is a universal black experience.
Right.
And so people try to question his blackness or the authenticity of his black voice.
Right.
And we need to really break out of that, because there's a lot of ways to be black, including being, you know, a biracial South African immigrant. Right. Like, exactly. That's still, his standpoint is still valid and it's his. Right. And it doesn't take away from his blackness because he doesn't see things or view things the way that every other quote unquote black person does.
Yeah, I really enjoy The Daily Show with him on it, because I said this a while ago, but I feel like I'm watching someone kind of like be immersed in our culture from an outside perspective.
Yes.
And he's learning real time, because I see his mind trying to like figure out and rationalize, like, which all of us have gone through. If you're black in America, you've gone through this. It's just, you went through this at six or
yeah, eight. Right, when you were a small child.
Yeah, like, you didn't, like, and I think, especially since he came from a place where you did have, racism, but it was just different. He's like, well, no, you do these steps and you talk about it this way and you get a reconciliation panel and stuff. And I'm sure there's still issues there. It's not like, oh, and then everything was great, but in his mind, he's trying to process it through the way he came up, and I'm watching as he kind of slowly goes, oh, this is a different monster in America.
Exactly. And that's, I'm so glad that you brought that up. That is really the context, the lack of American understanding about the context of South Africa is part of the reason why people don't understand where Trevor Noah was coming from. Mm-hmm. Because all we know about South Africa was Mandela, apartheid activism, Mandela got free, everything's fine now. That is not the case.
Right.
They, number one, the truth and reconciliation process that they went through, there has never been such a process in the United States ever. Mm-hmm. So even their level of discourse around race is just more nuanced. And has more of a idea around accountability, but through a peaceful process, right? And dialogue and, you know, communication, all of these different things. So there's that. And then there's also the added straight up ignorance of most Americans of what the conditions are and what that actually looks like, to where the power differential between Black folks and white folks in the United States is such that we're not even on we're not even in the context of being able to have a dialogue with white folks about accountability, because they literally deny that race is an issue.
Right.
Continually, repeatedly, on both sides of the political spectrum, all of those things. And so we can't even fathom a Black person who understands that there are white people who really understand that racism is wrong and that racism is systemic.
Right.
Because we live in a country where they won't even admit it. They say things like, I'm colorblind.
Right, right. I don't see color. You know, and I remember, of the late night people, his part where he talked about Philando Castile, to me, touched me. Like, that was the most, that was the best coverage of the Philando Castile verdict that I heard, because and I think it's because he was genuinely shocked. Like,
yes, exactly.
He's like, it's like, I can't believe there's a country where that tape exists and this officer doesn't go to jail. And those are, you know, I think those are valuable moments, because he is teaching a mostly white audience through his they're watching that too. Like, it's not just I already know how I felt about it when I first heard about it, but
right,
there's
right.
a lot of people that are like, but even Trevor's affected by this, and we're gonna need those folks too, as far as to witness those things. How do you keep your faith in people, man? Because I know after you guys protested at Netroots, the response on social media and stuff like that was just so harsh, and in the media, like TV is, you know, your pictures on there, and
I just want to use this opportunity to clear up the discrepancy about whether or not I was paid by George Soros. I've never received a check. If there's one available, you know, you can contact me.
You too?
So I can receive it.
He owed me some coins too, dog. Apparently, I was an operative for Bernie So Black. I knew. And planned for that to go viral. I typed it in and I said, voila, and I walked away. And I knew, cause you know how we always know which tweets are gonna go viral. And I remember, it got so bad with the harassment and stuff. One time I was linked to a Reddit thread, and in the Reddit thread they were like, yeah, he was paid by George Soros. And I'm like, I don't even know who that is. Right. I'm like, he paying people? Cause like, what I gotta do? I mean, I already did the work for free, apparently. I didn't even know, but can I get some coins on the back end? Maybe it'll make up for this harassment. Like, what was that backlash like for you after that?
The backlash, so this is where I, you know, and again, I'm from Arizona, okay? Born and raised. I have literally face down armed white rednecks, okay, at protests. Mm. I have never feared for my life and felt threatened, physically threatened, until the Netroots protest.
Mm.
Because liberal white people who got angry at us for interrupting and, you know, as far as they're concerned, disrespecting Bernie Sanders, like, Rod, I'm not exaggerating, confronted us physically.
Wow.
Like, in your face. I had a, like, 6'3", large white man get very close to me. And when I realized that he was, you know, being hostile and what he was saying to me, I had to, like, I screamed on him and was like, somebody come and get this guy. He's attacking me.
Right.
And it was almost like, and this is what I love about, Black people, you know, you talk about how I keep my faith in humanity. Yeah. The way that we're able to kind of coordinate and look out for each other and very quickly make the decision like, okay, we all need to leave. Let's get out of here. And really, you know, had each other's back instinctively really helped me to understand that the issues that we're talking about, again, it might be fun and cute in tweets for some people, but this is about our humanity, mm-hmm. As Black folks in the diaspora, and may it, you know, never be made as clear to you as being shot or having to defend your right to call out these issues, to other white people, because if I wasn't already, you know, a radical and woke and all that other good stuff, like, that moment did it. And I know it did it for a lot of other Black folks. And even the discourse on Twitter, like, Bernie So Black hashtag will live in infamy because of how it just captured the hypocrisy, of white folks of all sorts, but especially mm-hmm. those people who call themselves like the friendly white folks who are quote unquote on your side. I didn't know there's a side to my humanity.
Right.
And the way that I keep my faith is that, you know, I have faith in God. I'm a believer, and I know that the work that I'm doing, the work I've been privileged to be a part of through Black Alliance for Just Immigration, the people that I've met, you know, this is a call that is on my life, is to advance justice in love. That's what I'm here to do. And I know and understand through having, you know, worked directly with being a directly impacted person myself, and working with other directly impacted people, I see just the beauty and the strength that we have. And I know that if that's what exists within us, there has to be hope. There has to be, and how I keep my perspective is not just on looking at how bad things are and how sordid and, you know, far from God so much of humanity is. I keep my perspective on, you know, how beautiful and powerful and resilient folks are in the face of systemic oppression. And I really have to, you know, keep my mind stayed on Jesus, because I have to be honest, when I woke up on January 1st, the first thought in my mind was, oh, I can't stand white people. Like, so, you know, 20 days from Inauguration Day.
Yeah.
And that was like my first lucid thought. And I said, oh, no, Tia, this isn't healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. It's funny because I feel like people that are activists and stuff, like, I'm sure, like, it's overwhelming cynicism that you have to face, you know what I mean? Because you do have to watch how many people in the world that are just, like, anti-you. Like, as a human, as a concept, and a human being, and a record label, they are just anti-you. But something motivates you to get up and believe that people can change, or at least be made to change, made aware. You know, Harriet Tubman, like, literally had visions of God. Like, I remember, James Baldwin says, he had hope because he wakes up every day. And, like, as long as I'm alive, I gotta have hope. Like, that's the two choices. So, yeah, it's exactly. Interesting to, you know, because I lose my faith in people so easily. At times, I'm just like, man, this is why we deserve the shit we have, because y'all ain't shit. And then, but
everybody's trash,
right? But there are moments and people that do inspire me, and you're definitely one of those people. Yeah, man, that was like super, like not just the Netroots thing, but just, you know, as a human being, like, you're a very inspirational figure. The other thing that I think is funny, when it comes to, like, getting our, like, having hope in people, I feel like we need inspirations. Like, are there people that have inspired your activism or that inspire you, like, kind of every day?
Yes, definitely. So, you know, I shared about my mom, Ellen Oso, who was my first example of what it means to, like, stand up for justice. Like, and my mom literally, like, rousted a crack house out of our neighborhood. She used to lead, like, community cleanups where we would literally, like, walk the streets of the neighborhood and pick up trash and broken glass and things like that. Mm. And she's my personal example and also just the epitome of how hard Black women will go for the community. Mm. And so she inspires me, you know, Harriet Tubman for sure. Really the, like, radical resistance of, you know, enslaved African people who led uprisings, and, like, you know, Nat Turner, Queen Nanny of the Maroons, like, resistance stories where people were like, give me liberty or give me death, you know, and I know it's a super, you know, colonial reference. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But,
give me liberty as a white man or give me death.
From what? From Texas?
Yeah. Liberty for me specifically and no one else. And no one else. But just me.
You know, about how people want Black folks to protest peacefully, but this country has literally been overthrown at least one time and almost twice.
Right, right.
By white people.
Right, just because they was mad. Like, no.
Angry. I had enough.
Over taxes. Like, not even, like, actual injustice, but, like, what? 15%? Like,
outrage.
Right.
Also, Opal Tometi, my sister, my Niger sister, who, you know, we literally, people don't know, like, it's all glamorous and cute now, and, you know, she's a co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. She's actually the one who helped to create the platform that Black Lives Matter, you know, lived on or was proliferated through, and, like, did a lot of, like, the structural organizing for Black Lives Matter to exist. And she and I used to meet in, like, church parking lots in Phoenix and try to figure out, like, how are we going to get these Black people together? Like, people don't know the things that we have been through in the trenches together. And so she definitely inspires me every single day as well. And yeah, just loads of other Black women who just put the culture on their back for a lot of reasons. You know, Cardi B inspires me. Like, just...
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of... there's not a lot of reverence or respect for hood individuals. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of respectability politics that goes into, you know, what it means to be upstanding, or a role model or inspiration. And I come from a very, you know, hood round the way background. And just because I'm able to articulate myself well, it's not something that people assume about me necessarily. And I just feel like there's no reason that we need to kind of sanitize ourselves in order to assert our humanity. Like, we can be our full selves.
Yeah, I feel like so much of, at least the place I'm at in life right now, is about understanding and loving us where we are and then pushing us to be, you know, like, I want us to be better. I think everyone in life should be trying to be better than they were yesterday. I don't think that's so controversial to say, but also, like, loving us where we are. And, like, sometimes I think about the critiques of our community and how much of it is just unfair, and how, like, what's fair and what's not fair, right? Like, I think it's fair to say we can treat each other better. I don't see how that's, you know, like, a horrible thing to think, but, you know, it's unfair to say, like, we're pathologically criminal. Like, it's you know, it's unfair to expect there not to be a diversity of opinion. Like, you know, sometimes I'll see people kind of articulate a nuanced point and they'll get jumped on because they're not in lockstep with what we decided that Blackness should be on at that time,
but they're not
you know, and I know I made a joke earlier, but they're not coons. Like, they're not, I hate you niggas and y'all are holding us back as Black people. Like, it's, but they'll say something like, I don't know, you know, it's difficult for me because, my cousin was killed in a gang shootout. So sometimes, you know, and I'm like, I don't want to dismiss your emotions behind that, 'cause obviously that's fucked up. That's terrible. But sometimes I think we're so scared that that black person is going to either reject us or they're gonna parrot some like white supremacist talking point, and so we jump on them to get them back in line. But it's like you brought up about like debate and intellectual like discourse and quiet conversations. I do kind of feel like I want to be more towards the quiet conversation. I want to have more discussion rather than debate because of that. Like, I, you know, the reason we have this platform, I want to go away from the spectacle of fighting each other. But you're right, we pick and choose our faves. I think a lot of sisters love Cardi B and they really lift her up now because it is kind of a rebellion. Like, there was a, like, I don't know that Cardi B is a perfect person, obviously no one is, and so it then becomes to some people about like tearing her down and wherever her, anything she's ever said or done that's, you know, out of line, she, they, like, people are looking for the tweets, like, they just
trying to expose her, right?
Right. And I'm like, but y'all do realize people are celebrating her because she's not the codified black academic, like, filtered, focus group tested, have the right answer all the time person. Right. Like, that's why they love her, you know. When Beyonce got super duper woke on the last album, even though she's never shied away from blackness, but that last album was like, blah, damn, you know what I'm saying? Like,
listen, Beyonce's like, I am grown and we are going to talk about it.
Right. And I remember people kind of like coming at her from these like almost like black academic angles of like, and I'm like, but this ain't that. Like, we have to learn to love people, because we're not all going to be the same. And there's a lane for the like, there's a lane for the bell hooks as well as the Beyonce. Like, they don't have to be at odds. Like, I don't think they have to, it has to be about one of them is right, the other one is wrong, it has to go. But I feel like we often get into that, you know, I love so and so but I hate this other person because they disagree. And that's a fine line to balance, you know.
No, it definitely is. And yeah, you brought up so many good points. I really think that at the root of a lot of it, a lot of the turmoil that we have in our communities and this kind of wrestling to make folks toe a certain line, you know, that has roots in colonization, honestly, and the way that we were able to resist and the, you know, civil rights movement and assimilate into this country was to create a quote unquote, like a, you know, united front and a unified front, but that appealed to whiteness and white sensibilities. And so that's where the, you know, dressing up for the civil rights marches and things like that comes from. And because that's a way that we were able, an avenue we were able to use through, you know, respectability, and decorum and being civilized, because that's a way that we were able to fight for our, you know, humanity in this country and in other countries. I think that that still that policing of what's dignified and what's respectable and who gets to be the face of our community, who gets to be a leader in our community and who we look up to, I think a lot of that pours over and spills over into it. And the issue that I take with it, especially like critiques of folks like Beyonce or Nicki Minaj or Rihanna, or Cardi B, is that most people, because of the, you know, just like class structures of the United States, most black women, right, are less than academically, you know, PhDs.
Right.
Most women enjoy, you know, music and laughter and fun and being sexy and cute and, yes, wearing weave and nails sometimes.
Right.
And it shouldn't be such that I have to be serious and neutral and, you know, assimilate to white ideals in order to be respected. And, you know, like you said, there are several lanes that we can all be in. We shouldn't have to fit into certain molds and certain boxes in order to, I feel like it's really about trying to justify our humanity. And then when we attack each other in that way, when we don't make room for one another, or hold space for one another in a certain way, unless we agree with each other, it's like, well, you know, like everybody's being dragged or that person's trash or this person's canceled. And it's like in real life, you don't need to be X'd out of the community because we don't happen to disagree. Like, I feel like there's a way for us to, again, this is, you know, organizing philosophy. There has to be a way for us to agree on certain conditions that we're trying to work to meet, right, and then have a diversity of tactics and strategies to get us there. And if the reason why you want freedom, if what freedom and liberty looks like to you is to not have any type of gun violence in your community and you're less worried about police violence,
right,
that's fine, actually,
right,
and valid, and it doesn't invalidate your blackness to be like that. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood where there was drive-bys and we had to sleep on the floor sometimes, and I understand what people are saying when they say, right, you know, these are the things that I'm actually more concerned about than police violence. What's not okay is when we use those arguments against one another,
right,
and not against the system. And like, this is, I'm just such a stickler for a political education and critical analysis, is that we have to understand actually what's at the root of it. The root of, you know, intra-community violence is not because black people have a problem.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
I remember an interview Kendrick Lamar did, and I like, listen, I love Kendrick, but it's, you know, he also a nigga from Compton that grew up, right, with his friends getting killed,
mm-hmm,
over gang shit. Like, he doesn't have the distance from that to come up with these broad sweeping academic theories of,
exactly,
like, to him it's just, I look at myself and go, why, what's the value of a black life if I'm willing to take one over a piece of street that's not even mine,
mm-hmm,
and then I want to turn around and judge somebody else without even thinking about what that means for me. Like, to me, I'm like, wow, that's a deep philosophical question from a dude that, you know, is just a quote unquote, just a rapper. Like, I love that he's doing that introspection. I think a lot of us should. And instead it's like, well, you know, white people are going to hear that and think that it's okay to kill black people with the police. I'm like, right, oh, fuck. Like,
we're so worried about what white people are going to think.
Yeah. Right. Like,
instead Cardi of engaging the discussion, I feel like, can we just accept, and also because we give a platform and give like a greater weight to what, you know, rappers and other, right, you know, athletes and other people like that say, why couldn't we just take Kendrick's comments for what it was? It's like, this is his perspective and his opinion,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, it lacked an analysis of colonization, right, and systemic racism in what he said in that soundbite. Okay,
right,
fine. Why can't we just take it for what it is?
I said, at the time, I was like, it would be disingenuous for me to be like, I mean, first of all, nobody gets canceled. I don't know. I really wish people would even stop saying it. Cause
yeah, we gotta stop saying
nobody's
that.
Ever been every, all the hashtag canceled. Everybody's still around. Like, they just pop up and I'll be like, oh damn, I guess it didn't work. So, right. Listen, but the thing is though, I felt like a lot of people are being dishonest because we have those conversations intra-community all the time.
Yes, all the time.
But he said that shit in Rolling Stone and it was like, no, see.
Not in front of the white,
right,
people.
Right, right. What the white people gonna think? I'm like, the white people don't care, guys. If they cared, we would have had solved this already.
But
like,
you know what white people do is the Fox Newses,
right,
and the Rush Limbaughs, who, isn't it interesting? Oh, there's just so many things I want to talk about with you. Isn't it interesting how rap music is trash and low culture, but if a rapper says anything, it could be weaponized to explain the black condition.
Immediately. Listen, that was the thing that was weird about Eminem at the BET Awards was, because I saw like black people arguing with each other, and I was like, I absolutely refuse to argue with another black person over Eminem. I'm not doing it.
I sure won't. I sure thank you.
Like, too much stuff. Like, have whatever opinion you have it. Like, I'm not even trying to fight you over it. What I thought was interesting was I felt like the conversation all started because white people paid attention to this one hip-hop cypher because it was Eminem.
Because the white dude was rapping.
Yeah, like, and you know what? If that was the whole purpose, was for him to be talking to white people about Trump, okay, thank you, mission accomplished, I'm out. This literally has zero to do with me. Gather your own, as they say, like, gather your own folk, Eminem.
Yes, yes.
And I'm done with it. But I do think, the other point I want to make is, sometimes there's this fine line between jealousy and justice. Like, what are we feeling envious about, like someone's platform, the attention they got, money, you know? And then there's justice, right? Like, for example, I remember after Formation, when Beyonce performed that at halftime and just like stole, I forget who was, but was it Coldplay? Was it U2? I don't know who it was, but
some white band.
Yeah, stole they whole, just ganked they halftime. Like, it became the Beyonce Formation halftime. I think someone else was there too, but I don't remember. But
Bruno Mars was there.
That's who it was. Bruno Mars was there.
But so, it was somebody else.
Yeah, but nobody cared. I don't know who. Yeah, nobody cared. She ganked that halftime, and I remember being like, one, super inspired, because she literally had put that song out the day before and stole my whole afternoon. And then, you know, I couldn't believe somebody was doing something so black at the Super Bowl. Like, just,
no.
Oh my, like, I kept being like, are they gonna shut it down? Are they gonna make her wear something different? Are they gonna be mad about her dances? Her dances out there looking like Black Panthers. I said, what is happening? And within like, I would say a day or so, I started reading the think pieces. Cause, you know, on our podcast, we definitely do stand for Beyonce. And some of the stuff, I'm like, this isn't even about her. It's about jealousy that she's kind of in your lane a little bit. Like, there was a guy who wrote a book, a think piece that was like, well, Beyonce's still a capitalist and her da 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 da, neoliberal, this, that, and the other. And I was like, yeah, but at the end of this article, you're linking me to sell to your book. Like, you want me to buy, like, you ain't doing nothing for free either. Like, it's very, like, no one person is above the economic system of our country. Like, I don't think, if we're gonna change our country's economic system, it won't be because one person was like, and you know what, I am gonna change the way the world works. Like if
not by yourself, no,
right? Like, it would take such a massive coalition and honestly a lot of white people to make this country reform in that way. So until then, get your coins. Like, and you're trying to get yours off of her, so what? Like, it's the same thing. And then it clicked. Then it was, you know, it's been a couple of years, but it clicked at that moment. I was like, oh, this is jealousy. Like, this isn't, there's a difference. Like, there's a this thing isn't right and blah, blah, blah. And then there's a, well, this is the right point, but I don't like who's making it.
I don't like who's making the point. Yeah, and there's a lot of, so I feel like the critiques of, in particular, Beyonce's activism are really rooted in misogyny and anti-blackness, because they create, they set a different bar for her to meet.
Yes.
When all she is doing is expressing, you know, using her artistry and, yes, her platform that she's amassed through her own volition, right, and labor. This is what she chose to do with her time and talent. They set a bar that's unattainable, or a bar that she wasn't even trying to meet, in order to critique her. And so I think that critical analysis is important, but using critical analysis to attack a person, that's beside the point. Like, Beyonce never said, I'm the most woke, you know, socialist, and I'm bringing down the system by performing at the Super Bowl. That's not what she said.
Right.
I am, you know, Beyonce the artist, and I'm going to use my visibility and my platform that I have earned to bring attention to these issues in this particular way. And I feel like that whole year of performances that she did, the Grammys performance comes to mind with her and Kendrick doing Freedom.
Yes.
Like, that was the blackest thing.
Oh my God.
You're gonna see on the Grammys. That, you know, black dancers dressed like, you know, sexy Black Panthers standing in the X formation and the Super Bowl. Listen, she's putting the culture on her back in her way. And you do you. And I feel like it also has to do with this kind of sense of competition and degradation.
Yes.
As an academic, why are you not poised and ready for when somebody makes a cultural intervention? This is about now culture, like strategy.
Right.
When somebody makes a cultural intervention and opens up a space, as an academic, you should be ready, right, to right. come in and educate and engage folks. And instead, you've set yourself in opposition. Like I was joking with a friend of mine. I was like, people don't know that there's going to be weave at the revolution. Yes. Like there's going to be weave and twerking. Like instead of setting yourself up in opposition to the people who are now being awoken to these issues, you should be thanking Beyonce.
Yeah, it's like there can only be one. Like, and I feel like that shit is 100% about the white gaze, because white people only see us a little at a time, right? Like,
yeah.
They're like, Ta-Nehisi Coates, that's the black guy to go to for race
right
now.
He's the black guy right now.
Right.
He's the new Cornell.
Right. And then I'll watch us as black people kind of turn on slowly.
Turn on him, right?
And I'm like,
forgetting white attention.
Yeah. I'm like, y'all do know that he didn't like wake up and go, the white people gonna love this book. I'm sure when he wrote that, he was like, yeah, they not gonna ever fuck with me again, but it's cool. I had to get this truth out. And then, Blat Al, you know, he's on Colbert and they're being like, well, do you have hope? And he's like, hell no. Have you seen this country? And I'm like, why are we turning upset at him when it's Beyonce? Why are we turning upset at her? Like, if anything, we need more representation. We need more voices.
Yes, we need more.
Like, I'm not pushing to take the one person down that got through. I'm trying to push three more people through so that we look and go, look at this tapestry of black excellence and opinion all together right now. Like, look at that. That's what I'm, that's the goal for me. So yeah, like I said, it's a thin line between like that jealousy and that justice. Cause I really feel like, you know, if we examine where that stuff comes from, internally, I feel like we'll get to a healthier place. And I had to do it. I feel like a lot of people have to do it where, you know, there's certain people that make your eyeball itch, you know, because you feel like they're the only one, you know what I mean? Where you're like, oh,
yeah.
Like, I don't like, do I have a, like, I disagree with a lot of things, like, say a Charlamagne or a Steve Harvey says, or like, I disagree with a lot of that stuff, but my ultimate goal would be to have other voices out there that are being like, oh, no, 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 this is why this is, I disagree with that. Or here's another place you can go for an opinion from a black man that isn't so toxic, you know, like I need that too. Like I can't, it can't just be about let's tear this guy down and now we have no voices. Like now we got to have more. So that's, you know, that's my goal.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that. And I think, you know, podcasts in general, and especially your podcast and, the work that you're doing is contributing to that. And just strategically and, you know, energy wise, it's a much better use of our time and energy. And it's also it contributes to a more expansive, way of being to, you know, add and to multiply and to have a diversity of voices and opinions instead of taking time and energy to take somebody down.
Right.
Or drag someone, specifically from the standpoint of where I feel like a lot of the academic analysis comes from, you know, they're theoretically, they're trying to point these things out in advancement of the cause.
Right.
So you should also, we should just ask ourselves, like, is this going to advance the cause?
Yes.
You know, that I'm trying to propose.
What is like, the cause even more? Like, is the cause just me getting another speaking fee? Cause I'm like, what, like, what is the cause at this point?
Especially within the Black Lives Matter, you know, movement, a lot of people's issues and beef with each other is that, is somebody's getting a lot of shine, somebody's getting a lot of speaking engagements, now people writing books and making movies and things, and some of the motivation at the heart of it is hate, you know, and jealousy and envy, because I can, you know, say again that the it's not usually a lot of it is not stemming from like actual political ideological differences. It just isn't. Pretty much, I would say with the exception of maybe like the, like somebody like D-Ray, where people are like, he's neoliberal.
Right.
But a lot of the issue that people take with it is his visibility. Because if he was a neoliberal that nobody knew, you wouldn't have a problem.
Right. Yeah. And honestly, like, that's also the white gaze thing, because white people have decided, like, hey, we're going to call him. He's on the short list of people we want to interview. He's, you know, like, he's the guy whose tweets we're going to put on our TV show. He didn't get to decide that. You know, someone somewhere else did that. Like, I don't know DeRay like that. I don't know a lot of activists. I quote unquote know a lot of activists. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I know of their work. I'm not really, I'm friends with a couple people that are activists, but it's to me, like, I try to stay out of the beef thing because I legitimately, one, don't know who is, I'm supposed to feel like is fake or whatever. what I do know is a lot of people's work is good work as far as the goals of it, right? So, like,
yes, exactly.
Is the world better served by there being no DeRay? I don't think so. I think the world is better served by him doing his thing. Should he be the only person that people know? Like, it should be more than, like, it should be more room for than just one person. And I don't know that he would be responsible for, like, if he went away, I don't think it would just go, and now everyone else can come in. It'd just be like, and now we pick another one person.
Right. You know? Exactly. We have to understand, you know, and I'm really big on really understanding and having like a power analysis.
Yeah.
D-Ray doesn't control the means of production.
Right.
Right. So he's not the one who is the actual gatekeeper. He's going through the gates that are being opened for him. Those gates were opened for him because of certain, you know, right. channels and certain systemic, you know, right. Conditions, and also because of you know, the political context that we're in,
right?
And like you said, like, we really have to, you know, understand that if he wasn't there, it's not as though I would be the one, you know, that would right. be on, like, you know, all the nighttime talk shows, you know, laying down my analysis. I don't know if that is ever going to occur. I mean, right. I would love to, but I don't know that, especially given that I'm the girl who introduced, you know, the term systemic racism.
Right, right.
I don't know that they want to give me another mic. I'll have to take the next mic I can get.
Yo, also, but on the real though, that's one of the things that I always kind of point out is like, well, who gets through the gate? It's still got to be a person with the ability to make people comfortable, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a skill, and it's also, while it can be a hindrance, it also has also gotten progress for people in the past. Like, it depends on the person and depends on the cause, but you're not, the people who keep the gates open are never gonna, you're like, that's why, like, people were like, going back to Trevor Noah, like, I don't like that they got this dude from that. And I'm like, okay, here's the thing. Whoever got that spot, black or white, they weren't gonna be your super woke militant.
Right. Cause we saw what happened to Larry Wilmore's show.
Listen, I loved that show.
Me
I stand
too.
For that show. And I remember when it got canceled, I was on Twitter and I was like, man, I really hate that the show got canceled. What about all these black voices? I hope they find places, and they are finding places. Robin Thede's show starts tonight. So, like, they're finding places, and that's beautiful. But some of these people I may never see again. Holly Walker, Mike Yard, like the older yeah. black comedians, like, they don't get the second and third chances to be on TV. So, like, I'm gonna miss those guys. Like, I was really sad when it's canceled, and I remember saying that, and then like someone was like, well, what about that one show where he said this thing? And I'm like, yeah, that was, you know, bad show, bad take, I didn't agree with it. And you know, and it's like, well, that's why I'm glad they canceled. I was like, all right, I don't even know what to say. Like, what is the, so then
listen,
the show that takes their
power.
Place, right? I'm like, you do know the show that takes their place won't be a black show. So if
exactly.
the point is,
it's not, now they have a new show coming in and it's not. And the right. point is that now we have one less
right.
black platform.
Right. Like, I, you know, and like I said, I struggle with it, but I'm trying to learn to love people where they are. And especially, like, some people are just younger. There, we all went through the, like, super, like, I'm black y'all, like, everybody's
yeah.
gone through that. So I do understand the sentiment, but I'm like, I guess I'm at a point where I'm like, I'd rather have the black show that gets it right most of the time and they mess up sometimes, like all human beings, than the white show that I don't even want to watch. Like, I don't even, like, I'm not even interested in that show now, because I'm like, I had this beautiful blackness for a year and a half and it's gone, you know? So
exactly. Like, I have no intention of watching that show.
Yeah.
Now, whatsoever.
All right. So the last thing, I know we went over time, but I've enjoyed talking to you so much.
Me too. We didn't get to talk about, how black men hate you, Rod.
Oh man. Listen, I love black people and I love being a black man so much. Like, if they knew, I feel like it wouldn't be this way. But so people that out there that listen to the show, y'all already know the straight black man tweet I had. But I'll tell you this though, man. It has died down since I muted that tweet. And I feel like slowly more people are having to at least shut up, because it's getting so bad, you know what I mean? Like, it's like every week there's like another thing where you're like, isn't that interesting that this black man decided to say such and such? But I do think it's like pulling teeth when it comes to getting black men to let go of misogyny and patriarchy, because we really do think it serves us, you know what I mean?
And it doesn't. And it's a power source in the construct that we're in. And when we decide to, you know, get free and really decolonize, I've been really enjoying the 444 discussions and discourse around that, the 444 syllabus, and just the videos that content that Jay-Z produced, because we don't, you know, a lot of times when black men are talking about, you know, misogyny and just issues that they're dealing with, it is like your Twitter battles with people. It's like, you know, a black man who's holding the line and a black man who's like, I just think that we should treat women with respect.
It's, you know, it's a it's as much, and like you were saying, we're all connected, and this isn't that all struggles are equal necessarily, but it is just as much of a prison for us holding on to it as it is for what we do to other people. Like, obviously what we do is worse, like, you know, killing somebody is worse than your hurt feelings or whatever, but
it's rooted in your captivity system.
We can't be
black men don't get to talk about and existing in that.
We can't be fully formed human beings. Like, we're not allowing ourselves to be human, and this, no one's doing this to us, this is us. Like, you can free yourself of that if you're listening to this right now. Like, you don't have to hold on to this. Like, I'm trying to let go of so much of the stuff I've been programmed in my life, because, you know, what is the value of something that's holding me back, right? Like, and it's different for every person, but I examine certain things. I'm like, I don't need to hold on to that. I don't even believe in that. So I do wish people, and I think people are starting to, but like, this dragon, tooth and nail, it's kicking and screaming for this whole thing. Matter of fact, getting to the thing I was gonna say is the take a knee protest that people are doing for the NFL, right? Which, you know, a lot of black men got activated by that, like, oh, they told they told Kaepernick he can't have a job.
Listen, you know it's serious, people who know, like, black fraternity life and sorority life, you know it's serious when Kappas are organizing a protest.
Yeah.
That's how you know something is really going down.
Yeah, like, it's like, listen, all of us are work now, and we are, but I always kind of, I don't know, side-eyed that protest a little bit because of how it, like, when it came to that one topic, like, a lot of black men got super militant, but I'm like, what about the rampant abuse and misogyny? What about the, you know, like, all these other issues within the NFL before this that no one gave a fuck about? And it was like, well, just shut up, we here now, not us. And you know what, I was like, to a certain extent, I'm like, you know what, the greater good is that y'all are here now, maybe this will change something. And then, like, Cam Newton calls a woman a female, or Ezekiel Elliott gets accused of domestic violence, and I watch everyone go right back to, like, and I'm trash again. I'm like,
and I'm trash now again.
Yeah.
You know what? But that has a lot to do. I've been just learning more, you know, and trying to understand the dynamics between black men and women, really for my own personal development.
Right.
And really a lot of that has to do with that, you know, masculine energy of, like, dominance and control and, like, fiercely defending. Ending, you know, and so that's why we could ride out for Cap, because this is wrong, and just like, I'm a black man, he's a black man, and that's it. And so it's like, it comes from a place of, you know, defending, which that strength is necessary. But again, you know, when you look at, like, the creation of, like, Black Lives Matter or other things that black women lead, we come from a place of, like, for the greater good,
right?
And from, like, a more holistic standpoint, and that's why we need this shift, and we need to wrestle through these things, because it does end up actually opening up space for even Black men to also be more fully themselves and fully human.
Yes.
And that's what it's about. But for people who are so strongly identified with the dominant mindset of masculinity, it feels like a threat, right?
Right. I was thinking about that today. I was like, I was reading my friend's Facebook post. And she was saying how it was a joke, but it was, you know, there's always some, a little bit of truth in humor, right? She was like, I'm finally at a place. She was like, every time I see a Black woman, if she's with a white man or something, like, I'd be rooting like, go ahead, girl. And then she was like, well, if I see a Black man with a white woman, she was like, I finally come to a healthy place where I can say, he ain't that cute. And it cracked me the hell up, right? But then I was thinking about this and I was like, it's weird because of how we're conditioned via gender, it's like women are just bred and taught and ingrained and like nurtured to be the support system, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And men are by the nature of how we treat women immediately put in a situation where we go, and women are here to support us, right?
They are here to support me, exactly, and just to receive the support.
Right. So there's no, like, loyalty, quote-unquote, to that, because it's not like only Black women are nurtured that way. All women are nurtured to be, are told to basically be a support system for some man at some point. Like, that's your life goal, is to then turn around and support some dude, right? I don't find it wrong to teach people to nurture. I think that's beautiful. I just find it odd that we don't see it as a masculine trait or something we would want to teach men too. Like, we'll teach men to provide, quote unquote. We'll teach men to protect. But the, even within that, there's a hierarchy, right? I'm providing right. for you, which puts me above you.
Exactly.
I'm protecting you. This also puts me above you, right? But when I'm looking at like these marches and stuff, like when there's a march for Black women, it's only Black women out there.
Yeah. Whether,
you know, when a sister gets shot by the cops, there's so many Black men that will then turn around and start like sounding like white people with the whole like, well, why didn't she just do what the officer said?
What did she say? Why does she have an attitude?
Exactly.
Yeah, I noticed that specifically with the case of Corin Gaines. And yes. then there's a woman, Arizona State University professor, Ursula, I can't remember her last name right now, who was, assaulted by ASU, Arizona State University Police Department officer, and the discourse, and it wasn't just Black men, Black right. women get in on it too,
yes, yes.
who were really like legitimately questioning whether or not she should have had such an attitude
right.
and all of these things. I was like, this man dragged her to the ground and assaulted her for jaywalking, and I went to Arizona State University. That wasn't even a thoroughfare. The street that she was crossing wasn't a busy street.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't even matter.
Police brutality. Why are we debating whether or not she deserved that treatment? And
right.
yeah, it's just so, there's so many layers to it, and a lot of it has to do with, not because, you know, there's a difference between genders, but because of the lack of balance, the lack of respect, because of like the hierarchy that's ascribed to it, and also because we live in, you know, a patriarchal system, the privilege that is ascribed to men that also absolves them from accountability, right? So
right.
if a woman is less than nurturing or somehow doesn't meet a societal standard of, you know, women's role in society, she will be dragged. But if
right.
a man doesn't provide for his family, if a man is less than, you know, chivalrous or courteous
right.
or, you know, doesn't defend someone in a certain situation, his man has not taken from him
mm-hmm.
at a societal level the way that women who don't, you know, break our backs for everyone else are questioned and judged.
It's why we question Amber Rose's motherhood, but never Wiz Khalifa's fatherhood, right?
Like
they both out in the clubs. They both out doing
out
stuff.
The streets.
Like they, that's how they make their money. Like I ain't begrudging either one of them,
it's
but it's funny.
Exactly. It's always, well, what about your son?
Right. Right.
My daddy is Wiz Khalifa.
Right. Like what about my daddy? I need help on both sides. You know,
on both sides. Or like with the Future and Sierra and their
yes,
child.
Yes.
And people were so like just dragging her, you know, she's not worthy of Russell Wilson's love. Oh, she's disrespecting Future as a father. He disrespected himself.
Right.
Future just placed his own self, and the fact that it's immortalized, you know, by Jay-Z forever, I feel like we won that one. It's like, good.
Yeah. Somebody you brought up 444 earlier, and that was the conclusion I came to with 444, was just like, you know what, ultimately I'm just glad Jay got here. Like, it took him a long trip. that's a long trip, and I know he still got ways to go, and I'm sure everything wasn't, you know, perfect in the academic stance and all that. I know there had to be some problems. I saw people that still were resentful of a society that will applaud the growth of a 50-year-old man as opposed to what we say about young women. Yeah. I get all of it. I really do. But damn, man, I'm so glad you finally got there. Like, maybe somebody will listen. You know what I mean?
Exactly. That's how I feel. I feel like, you know, I will let other people make all the critiques, and I, you know, will snap right along. And also, I am glad that a black man that other brothers respect got there is opening up this space, because Lord have mercy. We need it.
But yeah, like I said, man, we're not bred to see nurturing as a positive as men. And I think that's a huge disadvantage to us. Cause not only do we need it as a skill, right? Like, it's like how people go, well, if you're a man, you need to learn how to cook for yourself. I agree. I don't know why only women would be the only people to learn how to cook. That doesn't even make sense. Half the people on the earth are not women. Like, learn how to cook. That's cool. But we don't extend it to other stuff that we call women's work. And women's work stuff is normally like the emotional labor and things of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we need to learn those skills too. They're valuable skills to have, to be supportive and to be, especially if you're going to turn around and be half or, you know, whatever your relationship stuff is. If you want to be half of someone's life, yeah, dog, you need to learn these skills too. It can't just be one way. But listen,
or if you want to, you know, be the president of the United States, it might be useful.
We see what happens when you put one of these totalitarian you know, fake ass alpha males in charge, man. That is what, low-key though, like and I know we didn't even really get into your politics like that, and I apologize, because I know we've gone over time, but low-key, I always like Obama because of how much he loved Michelle. Like, low-key.
Yes.
Like I understand, you know, he bombed a lot of people, and there's a bunch of negative things that people are going to have to say, and I think a lot of it's just the results of that office. Like, I don't think anyone's ever going to occupy that office that I'll be like, and that person did a perfect job. Like, I'm always be like, yeah, and then that, you know, they did this thing, and they did that thing. But low-key, that, like, the imagery of that family, and seeing, especially contrast to now, seeing a family that, like, a couple that seem to have genuine love for each other,
right?
And I don't know, like, that'll always stick with me more than probably any policy or anything he ever, like, a scandal-free 8 years with him loving the hell out of three black women in his life,
right.
And
right.
You know, a dude that was a feminist and outspoken and all that stuff and not scared, and I wish more people would have embraced that part of him, as far as because, you know, people like the imagery of, oh, black man in office, we had a black president. But then I'm like, okay, brothers, but what about, like, his allyship to LGBTQ movements? What about his love for black women? What about his the fact
black
that
women, children,
yes,
you know, the environment, his diplomacy,
right?
You know, a lot of there is symbolically and, you know, kind of energetically, a lot of value to what the Obama presidency brought to us.
Right.
You know, we have been talking for a while, and, you know, you can have me back on, and we could dig into, you know, politics more. But yeah, no, I am on the same page with you about that, for sure.
Yeah, we got to do that, man. I didn't know this was gonna go so great, so I didn't.
I know.
I was like, oh my god. I was like, talk to an old friend. But listen, guys, if you want more of this, follow Tia on Twitter at Tia_Oso. Go to her website, TiaOso.net. I know you're also speaking now. You're also is there any other place that people can find you?
Folks can find me. I have a Facebook page, Tia Oso, and I'll be posting a lot of just, you know, I'll be posting more updates soon. I from, you know, all my activism and organizing, and then the cherry on top of last year's election, I have taken myself off the front line of organizing and giving myself a break and a sabbatical this year. And so I have a lot of things in development that I'll be, you know, rolling out. But right now I'm just kind of, you know, giving myself a break, you know, pulling off my super black woman cape for a little while. So yeah, folks can tune into my Twitter, Facebook, and the website for updates and things.
Two things about that. One, I understand. Okay, it's open season out here. Be careful, people. Like, this is not like, this ain't like before. You know what I mean?
It's not.
So yeah, be careful out there. And then two, thank you. You know, you, like I said, you're an inspirational person and you do so much. And, also, you know, like I said, when you got on that stage, man, I was just so inspired. And I remember, whenever I would get interviewed afterwards, it was so funny. They were like, we want to interview about this trending hashtag. I was like, okay, but I wasn't even on the stage. I didn't, like, what about that though? Like, let's go back to the, and I was like name dropping people, and they were still like, they're just so sloppy. Like, the media is so sloppy. Like, I would be like, well, y'all should interview Tia Oso. Like, y'all should interview people.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, that's nice.
Yes. And then, and then in the article, they'd be like, Black Lives Matter activist Rod Marr. I was like, no, I didn't know. Do not put that on me.
Everybody like, was a Black Lives Matter activist except for the co-founders and the people doing that.
Oh my God, man. Like, I know you talked about, the organizing of it, which is like a brilliant structure. But oh my God, the media completely just like threw that away. Like, they were just like, because nope.
It doesn't compute to have, and you know, I've really learned a lot about this since the time, it doesn't compute to have an uninvited, you know, full figured, nappy haired black woman running things and being the center of attention. And it was almost as though trying to filter all of that through all of our lenses, everybody was just like, so. And also part of it is the kind of what we're talking about as far as black women's labor being expected is like, oh well, they did that and now we get to decide how we feel about it and talk about it, and we don't really necessarily need to ask them. I would say shout out to Mark Lamont Hill. He's one of the folks who did invite myself and some of the other organizers. They had us on Huffington Post Live like right after, and a couple of other times. There are a couple folks who did, you know, get it, gave us the courtesy, right, of a follow-up discussion. But yeah, there's just, I just, it's a case study in media analysis.
It is. And I know strategy wise, there were people that were like, well, we don't want to do interviews yet, or we don't want to go on every outlet and stuff like I get that. But in absent of people doing an interview, I still don't understand how you then turn around and be like, well, listen, any black person we talk to, just call them Black Lives Matter. Like, how did that step happen? Like, wouldn't it just be like, well, we couldn't get a spokesperson for Black Lives Matter, but we got this Negro. You know what I mean?
And you know, because the thing is, I feel like that's the beauty of, you know, just black people. We are magical. You know, people act like black culture, black politics, black everything just appears out of thin air.
Yeah.
Snatch it and apply it however I would like. Oh, Rose, that looks beautiful. These are now boxer braids. Matter, that sounds catchy. Let me, you
know. That's what they mean. Black, they're like, black girls are magic because they're invisible. We don't even see them. We just take their work and we just pop up, guys.
Real, or is it a figment of our imagination?
Oh yeah, they're magical, like that Harry Potter cloak where you just disappear. Like, okay. All right, guys, thank you so much. Tia, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it. I gotta have you on a regular show. I'm gonna hit you up about that so you can come out here from behind the paywall and talk to all the people. Like I said, follow her work, and we'll be back with another one of these soon. Until then, peace out.